This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Richard Adey. This is Best Practice. Ask anyone if they'd like a bonus and they're pretty much certain to say yes. If I was offered one by some senior head honcho here at the ABC, I would accept like a shot. You had me at lavish, I'd say. We're going to talk about bonuses later in the show. Let's begin with dissent. If you're like most people, you won't like it. You'd rather go with the flow. Disagreeing with others, for most of us, is uncomfortable and difficult, which explains why it's rare. But as Charlotte Nemeth makes clear, it's also incredibly valuable. The author of No, The Power of Disagreement in a World That Wants to Get Along, says organisations need rebels. Even if they lead to conflict, the pain is worth it. And she says, if you disagree, you should say so. But it is incredibly hard for most of us to do.
Yes, it is. I mean, that's one reason why people don't speak up generally. They will if they're, you know, with the consensus and they're able to, back someone whose support that they want. But if they're at all challenging the discussion or a position being proffered, they're usually very reluctant to speak up. In fact, I think the stats the last I saw were about 70% of people here in the U.S. will report that they don't speak up even when to report a problem. That's a big problem in itself, because then you don't really know what's going on in your company because people are fear being upfront and straight about it.
And you've got, I suppose, some helpful advice for people on how to do this. And one of them I was dismayed to read. I'd get this wrong all the time. So you say, don't ever preface your opposition by saying, just to play devil's advocate.
Right. I could almost go into a lecture on why not, but to be more succinct, when you play devil's advocate, you're basically role-playing. And so it's very difficult to know what someone really believes because they're play-acting, I mean, to some extent. You know, they're devising arguments and all of that, but it's not coming from conviction or from authenticity. And so what you find is that it can have negative consequences, actually. I mean, most of the time people try devil's advocate because dissent, a minority viewpoint, it isn't just a question of what of how they win. But even if they're wrong and even if they don't win, they actually stimulate thinking that by and large leads to better decisions and more creative problem solving. And it's primarily through the vehicle that they get you to consider more information, more points of view, consider the pros as well as the cons. I mean, all the things that you want to do when you want to make good decisions, is dissent actually stimulates that. And it turns out in a few of the studies we did, what we had really shown is that devil's advocate doesn't have those stimulating properties. And in fact, there's some unintended negative consequences where people were actually thinking more in support of their initial position, where the whole point of the devil's advocate in principle is to get you to consider alternative positions or to consider the negatives of your own position. And it doesn't do that, whereas authentic dissent does.
The thing about authentic dissent is that you've got to hold your ground until you're convinced otherwise. And again, that is much easier to say than to do.
Oh, absolutely. There are justifiable fears that people have to expressing a dissenting viewpoint in the first place. I mean, number one, they usually become unsure of whether they're right, partly because they think, how can I be right and everybody else is wrong? And so you're often off balance, but even if you're not, let's just say you're quite confident about it, there's still a great deal of fear of reprisal, of people both judging you negatively and more dire consequences. And the fact is that the dissenter, in fact, is punished, sometimes killed. That's what martyrs are about, you know. They challenge power or consensus and persist, and they're willing to die for it. And they do die. So, it's not as though you're going to stand up and be applauded by everybody.
No.
I mean, that's why the difficult part is getting people to do it. And that in part, I think, then falls on the leader and on the culture that makes that safe to do.
Well, the book is full of stories and examples that underline, I suppose, the importance of this. And one of the things that you talk about is if everyone's focused on one thing, they lose sight of relevant information and options. And you give that example, this is a very famous example, of the United Airlines flight 173. This is in 1978. And everybody's focused on one thing.
You know, I used it in part to make a dramatic point that decisions have consequences. And sometimes, you know, we wax sort of intellectually about, you know, the nuances of making somewhat better decisions rather than poor ones. But the fact is that the bad decisions can lead to, in that case, deaths. And it basically was a flight, I think, from Denver to Portland. And essentially, they felt there was something wrong with the landing gear in the beginning because the light that's supposed to come on didn't, essentially. So it looked like it was malfunctioning. And so they spent a lot of time trying to figure out what was wrong with the landing gear. This is after they're in the air, by the way. They mainly noticed the problem, of course, on approach. The bottom line of it is that they spend so much time thinking about the landing gear and what to do. I mean, they essentially form a consensus of where to put their minds and their focus. And in the process, they don't pay attention to the fact that they're running out of fuel. And what's sort of odd about it is that when if you read the transcripts from the cockpit, is that they're even asked about the fuel level, you know, from the mission control and from and at one other time from each other. And it's mentioned as a matter of fact statement with no indication at all that it has anything to do with running out of fuel. And the bottom line of it is that while they're circling in the sky about 5 miles away from the airport, that essentially they run out of fuel and that plane literally fell out of the sky and killed 10 people. The real issue though there is that when you focus on only one aspect of a problem, and we call it convergent thinking, so it's as though you have blinders on, is that what happens is that sometimes you don't notice even what would normally be obvious. So we've done like tons of studies, for example, where you'll find that simple consensus. I mean, you can have as few as three people agreeing on it, doesn't matter what it is they're agreeing on, is that what will happen is not only do you tend to follow them, but you start to think about it from their perspective. So if they're solving a problem in a particular way, you use their strategy in problem solving. If they're focusing on, you know, one aspect of a stimulus array, you only look at that part of it. You don't bother to look at the full array. So you miss things you otherwise would, and you don't detect novel solutions. So it's essentially a version of bias thinking in the sense that there's blinders on in all kinds of ways, whether it's the information you take in, the alternatives that you consider, the strategies you utilize. It essentially narrows focus, and it is very powerful. And it is done simply by virtue of the fact that there is consensus on essentially a position or a way of looking at something.
I don't think I'd realize that quite as clearly as you've just put it until I was looking at the book, because as you point out, it's not just here is the decision or here's the point of view and the majority want that point of view and we're social animals and so we go along. It's about how the whole thing is framed. And with all that sits inside that is determined by that consensus.
Actually, you put your finger on the essential element. I can't tell you how difficult it was, even in the beginning of doing this book, to really make clear the two different forms of influence. Is that the field, social psychology certainly, has defined influence for decades, at almost totally up until, you know, fairly, at least in the last couple of, you know, in a more recent history, as essentially winning, I call it. It's more like if you're at position A and I'm at position B, the notion is I've influenced you if you move from A to B. It's essentially winning. It's called, you know, it's opinion change, it's persuasion. I think the far more powerful aspect of either consensus or dissent is that it changes. Even if you don't move, even if you're not persuaded at all, it changes the way you think about the issue. So what it does is that you, in the case of consensus, you actually start to look at the issue from their perspective. So you narrow the range of considerations. So less information, okay, fewer strategies, et cetera, but importantly, it's not any old convergent thinking, it's their perspective. And that's why cults can be so effective, you essentially self-brainwash, is that with unchallenged consensus, it isn't that you just accept the position, you think that way. So you essentially become complicit, if you will, in the influence that's being exerted even on yourself.
Mm. And I suppose the inverse of that, dissent, it gives someone else permission to think differently. Once one person's doing it publicly, someone else, perhaps one other person, has permission to do the same.
That's right. Several studies that are sort of related to the point that you're making. One phenomenon that's been on the books for some time is that the power of the majority is broken once it's challenged by a dissenter. So even if the person is completely wrong, even more wrong than the majority or whatever, is that they crack the power of the majority over you. So one aspect that's important about dissent is that it's liberating, is that people actually know what they know. They start to think independently. They start to judge the accuracy of things the same way they would if had they not been subject to the influence. And so that becomes very important because it's a powerful corrective. But in addition to that, it actually widens the way you think. And it doesn't mean from their perspective, if it's a dissenter, it's from multiple perspectives. Now you consider what they think, what you would think on your own, and even new alternatives. So we've even had studies where it's linked to creativity as well. So there's an enormous value in dissent. And I think the important thing is it doesn't depend on whether or not it's correct. It's the fact that it challenges the existing way of thinking. We did one study where we actually titled the article Modeling Courage, because when they're exposed to dissent, like in one set setting, they're exposed to a dissenter who actually was wrong, making some judgments, and they thought the guy was crazy and they didn't follow him and, you know, the usual kind of findings. But then they were put in a new setting where they found themselves in a minority. Namely, they were in a typical conformity study where essentially all the other three or four people were all agreeing on an erroneous judgment. And what you find is that when they were not exposed to any dissent in the prior situation, just normally in that kind of a facing consensus on that particular task, about 70% of the people were following the majority. So they were calling red slides orange because that's what the majority was doing, even though they'd never say that if they were on their own. But when they witnessed dissent in the previous situation, even though they thought the guy was crazy, they thought he had no impact whatsoever, they now, in this new setting with new people, were more independent. They now knew red was red, and they said so. And so, you know, you get kind of dramatic differences that have to do with the power of dissent, both in terms of modeling them, namely the courage, as you put it, to speak up, which is one element. But you then have all these other elements that have to do with breaking the power of the consensus and in stimulating much more kind of open and divergent thinking.
Professor Charlene Nemeth from the University of California at Berkeley is the author of No, The Power of Disagreement in a World That Wants to Get Along. You'll find details on our homepage at abc.net.au/radionational. This is Best Practice on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Adie. Are you stressed trying to finish that PowerPoint presentation which you have to present in front of your colleagues? Maybe you're struggling to get the report done for your supervisor. My next guest says giving employees an immediate bonus motivates them to meet deadlines faster. Caitlin Woolley is Assistant Professor of Marketing at Cornell University and an expert in consumer motivation. She joins me now. Welcome, Caitlin.
Hello, Richard.
Now, how did you get interested in this area? Was it because you were getting paid lots of bonuses or none at all?
No, I was not getting paid bonuses. I was really interested in how we can think about doing work that we enjoy that we also get paid for. So how we can, you know, do work that we like to do, but then also keep doing it even though we're getting paid.
Right. So essentially you have found that we shouldn't wait until the end of a task to give an employee a bonus. You're suggesting that we give the reward midway or before the big project's finished.
Yeah, so I think that there is a stigma against providing rewards. People maybe have this belief that if you give people, like employees, rewards too soon, then they won't actually complete or follow through on the activity of the task that they're assigned, that providing that reward could actually cause them to not finish the task or sort of slack off. So I was very curious about this because a lot of the work that people do is paid. And so if rewards undermine interest in a task, then it would kind of be counterintuitive to how the typical workday works, right? That they're doing work to get the payment or the reward. And so I was curious whether you could actually make a reward come sooner, if that would make the task more interesting by creating a sort of fusion or connection between the work that you're doing and the reward that you're receiving. So rather than receive the reward, you know, 2 weeks later, you actually get it sooner and you can feel that benefit, that, you know, immediate sense of reward while you're actually engaged in the work task.
Do you know, I think some people listening now, Caitlin, are going to be thinking, hang on a minute, if you're getting paid to do something, shouldn't you just do it and do it as well as you can without feeling that you need to get a bonus?
That's true. Yes. People should be, you know, motivated to do the work in and of itself. But what we find is that when you give people rewards, it can also create that sense of doing the activity for its own sake. It's almost a way to make a task more enjoyable or more interesting in its own right. So if it's something that you don't really enjoy, it could be a way to increase that enjoyment or interest.
That's really interesting because obviously a bonus, that's an extrinsic reward. And you are saying what it seems to do is boost the intrinsic reward that's within the task itself.
Exactly. So we can take these extrinsic rewards, and if you make them so that they're more associated with the task, they're coming closer in time to your actual work task. So if you're doing some sort of reading for work and you get a bonus immediately for doing that, then you come to associate some of those rewards with the task itself. So the reading now is colored by those immediate benefits, rather than, you know, you doing the task and waiting and then receiving the reward, whereas it's very separate in time. You don't really feel that benefit from the reward in the task. So we can make extrinsic rewards come sooner, and they actually act in a way to boost intrinsic motivation.
That is fascinating. Now, what are we talking about? When we say a bonus, what do we mean?
So in my research, I've looked at both monetary bonuses, so paying people an actual monetary payment for a task. And I've also looked at other types of bonuses or rewards. So in one study, we actually looked at chocolate, which I think acts similarly to money, right? You can get the chocolate sooner or later if you're doing the task. But then in another one, I actually looked at the reward that was part of the activity. So if you're, say, watching a news program and you think about the immediate benefits you get from watching that program, it makes the task more interesting and enjoyable than if you think about the delayed benefits. So you can think about rewards that are both, you know, external to the activity like money, but also rewards that are internal to the activity like actual benefits that you're getting. Those can also be immediate or delayed.
Now I'm a bit confused. What's a reward that's internal to the task?
So, for example, with this study that was watching a funny news clip, it's enjoyable and it makes you laugh and it makes you engaged in the program. It's interesting. Maybe it makes you excited about a topic. These are things that you get in the moment while you're watching it, and they provide this sense of meaning, right? So this is sort of internal to the task. It arrives while you're watching the task, and they're more immediate. But you can get those same benefits that come about later with a delay, right? Like you can find a task interesting and sort of look it up later in time, and that would be a delayed benefit. But these are all kind of, they're internal to the task in the sense that they are, you receive them while you're doing the task. So at work, for example, if you find that you enjoy your colleagues or you're doing something that you're excited about or that you find really meaningful, that would be internal to the task. And then something like money would be external to the task, right? That's more extrinsic.
So have you come up with any guidelines on how often? Because if we're going to have more than one reward, you know, you have to work out a spacing, don't you?
I have not looked at this yet in my research, but the thing that I focus on really is the size of the reward. That's been the key thing that I've been thinking about and looking at, because I think what you can do if you're providing rewards sooner is you can actually make them smaller. So you can give little bonuses here and there, rather than waiting at the end to give one big lump sum bonus. And if you sort of sprinkle the rewards throughout, that can actually be more motivating than waiting at the end for a bigger reward.
Now, you did several studies, I think five, and in one you had people spot the difference between two images. How did that work?
This was a task that was designed to be moderately engaging. So like most tasks that people do for work, they're engaging and they are sort of drawn into them. So for this task, people saw an image and it was a spot the difference game, so to speak. So one side had one image and the next side was the same exact replicate, except there were a few things that were different. And so what the task was for participants was to find the differences between the two images. And we gave them a bonus for doing that. And we manipulated whether the bonus was delivered that day, right after they found the differences, or a month later. And then what we asked people was whether, you know, whether they liked the task, if they were interested in it, if they found it enjoyable. But the real thing for us was whether they wanted to keep going with that task and continue it after like the reward was removed. So now they don't have a chance to get a reward. They're just doing the task for its own sake. And we found that when we gave people the immediate reward, they actually were more interested in continuing the task and they chose to continue it and spend their own time on it, even though they weren't getting any extra payment compared to those who got no bonus or those who got a delayed bonus.
So these people, you made it clear to them after they'd had their small immediate bonus that there would be no further bonuses, but they were still more interested in continuing.
Yeah, so they wanted to finish the task and find that difference, even though, you're right, they didn't expect to get any bonus from that, and it was just their own time that they were spending on it.
You've also looked at, I suppose, the difference between the timing of reward and the size of reward, and I know you're very interested in that. So as I understand it, if you do an immediate versus delayed bonus, you get, I suppose, an improvement in performance, which is significantly better than a much larger bonus that you get later.
Yeah, we were wondering whether the reason that an immediate bonus is working is because it's arriving sooner, it's coming earlier, or whether it's just seen as bigger. So oftentimes people prefer sooner payouts because they're just worth more to them than receiving that same amount of money later on in a week, right? Like $2 to me today is worth more than $2 to me in a week. So we were curious whether this effect of the reward was contingent on the timing or if it was really driven by the magnitude. So this study that you mentioned is really teasing those apart and showing that you can give people a sooner bonus, an earlier bonus that's not as big, and it's actually going to be more motivating than a larger bonus, which I think is what, you know, really has implications for managers trying to motivate their employees. Because what it's saying is that you don't have to give these big, you know, giant payoffs. You can give someone like a small coffee even, or, you know, just a small gift for doing some job well, and that's going to be motivating for that person. You can deliver them actually more frequently than trying to, you know, wait to the end of the quarter and giving them a larger lump sum.
This depends, I suppose, Caitlin, on doing a task that you fundamentally find interesting. It's not going to make you interested in something you're not interested in already.
Yeah, this is an important part too. So we always study things that people, you know, they're interested in. It's work, but they still have some sort of benefit they're getting out of it. And I agree that if it's something that people really hate, if it's a really difficult task or something that people don't want to do at all, then it's going to be very hard to motivate them.
Yeah. I suppose what it does, giving a reward to reinforce something you're already interested in, it becomes a bit like how our brains regard our other, I don't know, hobbies or interests, things that we're happy to spend our own time in that we're not getting paid to do.
Exactly, yes. And that's what we think the immediate reward is actually doing. It's making the activity almost more like a hobby. Because when you're doing something that you're not getting paid for, you get this intrinsic value out of it, right? If you have any hobby that you do, like you run or you do some craft, doing that in itself is a reward. And so when you make something like work, if you provide a sooner reward, it's making that work activity seem almost more like a hobby. It's more like play than when you have to wait for that reward. That's what really makes it seem like work is having the reward separate from the activity, right?
Caitlin, your research really underlines how marketing is increasingly related to neuroscience, I think. Those little reward circuits in our brain being turned on. It's been fascinating. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Caitlin Woolley is Assistant Professor of Marketing at Cornell University. That's it for this week. Best Practice is produced by Mudita Dias. Our sound engineer is Amrita Betancourt. I'm Richard Adie.